The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Let's run through the announcements and then to our program. For those of you who would like to call in today and speak to our guest, retired Marine Corps Major Franz Gale, that number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring to be answered. I'll get it up on air as soon as possible. If you would rather do email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember that the Space Show is copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to download and share the MP3 files, pass them around, help get the word out about the importance and value of space. Please do not edit these programs and don't do anything commercial. And please, no written transcripts, even if for your own personal usage. If you have any secret desires or ideas of what you would like to do with the Space Show program, please do email me so we can discuss it and work it out. drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then don't forget we're podcasting, and we thank Andrew Grummet for his podcasting service, which is Gigadial, GIGADIAL.net. And the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast is on our website. Both of our newsletters, our podcasts are in iTunes, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, and the Microsoft Zoom service. If you have any questions about the podcast, please do get a hold of me, and let's see if we can't, in whatever is needed, work them out. Go to our website, thespaceshow.com. Remember, our comprehensive newsletter is usually uploaded Sunday evening. It has all of the details of the guest bios, the upcoming weekly programs for the Space Show, and it has a section for what's ahead over the next couple of weeks and months for the Space Show. This is the only place you'll find a future schedule. If you have any questions about what you see on the newsletter, please do let me hear from you. Also, if we have to change anything in the schedule during the week or get an announcement out to you, you're going to find it first on the website newsletter. So do check it from time to time. And you can subscribe to the very short email newsletter, which goes out earlier request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our program website, or you can download the shows. There's a Space Show store on the website. You'll see it up near the top. It says Space Show Gear. And above all, you'll see the support, the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And I can tell you that we only are able to exist because of the gifts that some of you make to the Space Show, One Giant Leap Foundation, and we're certainly appreciative of that. Remember, if you pay U.S. taxes, you get a donation, as we are a nonprofit, and if you pay California taxes, you also get a California deduction, as we are a California public benefit corporation. Remember also that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, do visit their website, which is secureworldfoundation.org. And our guest today is a previous guest on the Space Show. Franz Gale has been on the program many times. Briefly, Franz was born in Minneapolis, and his father was from Germany. Mom is American, and you won't believe it, but he actually did drop out of high school at age 16 and joined the Marine Corps on his 17th birthday. He left the Corps as a sergeant in 1979, attended the University of Minnesota and studied political science. He then went back into the Marines as an officer in 1983, and he served as an infantry officer, retiring as a major in 2002. During his career, he's attended many different schools, many different programs, Naval Postgraduate School. He has a Master of Science in Space Systems Operation. He also went to the Pentagon as a civilian science and tech advisor to one of the deputy commandants, where he is, I don't think he's working there today, but where he was working. He had another master's degree in national resource strategy at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, and he's a graduate of the Senior Acquisition Course. You know, one of the things I can say about Franz is that he is literally, and I mean this, a true American hero, responsible for saving thousands and thousands of lives in the battlefield in the Middle East, given his fight to better protect American troops. It cost him a lot to do that because he went against the the status quo of the way things are done in the military. He is a true hero. He's now down at NASA Ames, and he is studying at the Singularity University. And he was part of the SUSTAIN workshop that several of us attended about 2 years ago at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. They did produce the proceedings of our SUSTAIN workshop, known as a technology roadmap. It was delayed for who knows how long, and by the Air Force, and for who knows what the real reasons of the delay were. But it has still not been officially released, although Franz does have the final draft of the technology roadmap up on a website where people can now access it, and it will be in the archives. It's rather a long URL, so I'm not sure I can do it on air because it is pretty long. But you'll see it in the archives, and you'll be able to download the 200-page document if you want. And Franz has a lot of new information to share with us about the technology roadmap from that SUSTAIN workshop. So welcome back to the program, Franz. And how does it feel to be a student again?
Hey, thanks, David. Thanks for the kind words. Singularity University, and I hope, is the echo okay now?
It's still there, but we'll live with it.
Okay. Singularity University is just an incredible experience, and I feel very fortunate to be here. I feel kind of underqualified to be here compared to some of my other students. I've taken the space track here, and so really a focus on space debris, perhaps space-based solar power, but anyways, it's a space focus. It's wonderful being a student, I'll start out with that.
You've already got a phone call, even though we haven't really talked about anything to do with the roadmap yet.
Sure.
Why don't you give us, and caller, I'm going to keep you on hold for a minute. Give us the 101 on the technology roadmap, because that's really what we're going to be sort of focusing on for most of today. And then I'll take the caller. So, what do you have to say about the roadmap? The fact that the Air Force wouldn't let you, or wouldn't let Paul or anybody release it, and it now is up on a website. Go for it.
Yeah, well, I'll try to be nice about everything. Obviously, the roadmap didn't get published. Very, very frustrating all this time. Frustrating on the last show I talked on. And so as a result, in the meantime, as you listeners probably know, the National Security Space Office under Mr. Rouge was disbanded. And another sad event, because Mr. Rouge was really the champion of the roadmap, and we were moving towards approval so quickly. And then things changed. And, no names are necessary, but there was a leadership change at a higher level in the Air Force. And there was suddenly less interest, maybe familiarity, but certainly less interest in publishing the roadmap. And so the Air Force, having initiated the project, as under the NSSO, having partially actually funded the project, sponsoring the event down in San Antonio, and certainly putting out an RFI and countless man hours somehow simply decided it wasn't interesting anymore. And that's of course, a shame. So that's where we're at right now. I feel bad for the Air Force as an institution, really, because there's so many wonderful space professionals in the Air Force. But I got to tell you, my personal opinion is that based on this type of behavior, this type of leadership behavior on the Air Force's part, it really is time to consider a separate Space Force or a separate service. This was the most infuriating process, certainly for the people who participated in it, in industry, and on our side on government. I don't think the Air Force is serious about being a steward for space in the executive agent sense. So I think it's time for a new structure, a radically new structure, if space is going to move forward. Bottom line is the government at this time, there's no way they can lead the roadmap or any part of its implementation.
Why did the NSSO get disbanded?
The exact reasons, I'm not qualified to say. I've got to be quite frank, because some things I just don't have the insights in. And I've also been out of the loop for some time, as I probably mentioned on the last show. I'm still out of the loop, and I'm not working in the Pentagon, although I still carry all my titles and all that stuff, but I'm at home. So I'm a little bit out of the loop on why. I think it's a tragedy, because Mr. Rouge, he's a hero to me. I mean, he was really forward-leaning on this and many other matters. And for whatever reason, it's the bureaucracy came in the way again of fulfilling vision. And so that's about the best I know.
Now, before I bring Dr. Jurist up, who is the gentleman on the line, with some questions and comments for you, real briefly, so my understanding is that while the draft is up on a website and listeners will be able to access it, you are in the process of doing some edits to that draft, and it's possible the Singularity University may issue it as one of their projects?
I will, first of all, caveat that, as I have in the past, I do not represent the government or Singularity University as a student right now in anything that I'm saying. It's still personal opinion and also the facts as I know them today. That said, I do say that I have discussed the possibility of rewriting the roadmap in such a way that the Singularity University might consider placing their stamp on top of the document if it becomes a constructive document for them as well. I don't want to speak for the university. All I can say is that I am busy working on rewriting the document, but rewriting should not be understood as rewriting content. The content of the roadmap is great, the way we've all worked on it together all this time. It's just an ownership issue. In other words, shifting from Air Force ownership, which obviously they do not want to take ownership of, to a different authoritative agency's ownership. Again, this plan has not been blessed in the sense like, hey, that's what we're doing, by Singularity University. However, I can say safely that there has been no negative reception of the idea, and I'm obviously working diligently on it.
Okay. John, hi, welcome to the show, and Franz John Jurist is on the line, wants to talk to you.
Hi, Franz. Sir. How are you?
Go ahead, you're both on.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Franz, I have a question that goes back a ways. Back in the summer of 2004, in the proceedings of the U.S. Naval Institute, you wrote an article in which, my understanding is, you argued for a separate space service because even at that time you believed the Air Force to have been failing in managing a lot of the space programs that have security implications. Now, if you couple that with the dissolving the NSSO, how has that changed your opinions or evolved your opinions in the intervening 7 years?
Well, sir, it's made my conviction that much stronger, and since I'm at the university here, I'll say exponentially stronger. I don't think I would have changed a word in there. I would have made my words much sharper now because of this experience. Dissolving the NSSO, using the very narrow, specific topic of the roadmap as a typical example, as a case study, in where combining the word Air Force and space in the same sentence is personally seen a joke. It's becoming a joke amongst the industry for sure, and it's becoming a bit of a joke in the DOD itself.
But they have Space Command. I don't get this at all, either one of you.
Yeah, they do. They do. They have a core mission, and they do their core assigned mission very well with technologies that mature through the standard space industry pipeline over bazillions of years, usually over budget, which is just the nature of the traditional space business. However,
also,
there is no vision.
Recall,
there's
David,
no...
that the prior commanding general of the Space Force's division of the Air Force has actually called for a new space service itself.
I like that. I think that's great, because I think he probably recognizes himself the intrinsic difficulty of a service with a Title X mission that absolutely requires in the near term the ability to fight its mission, as stated in the aerospace, the terrestrial aerospace regime, having a basically a conflict of interest, because space, I won't even include high altitude inner space. I won't even include that. I'll just say outer space, orbital and higher. That's a domain to itself, and they can't do it because they've demonstrated that they can't do it. There's no logical argument for the Air Force to have the space mission. There's no logical argument, and there is a precedent, a demonstrated failure to show vision in that regime. Now, early on, of course, I mean, as we say in the roadmap, it was the Air Force that was the first visionaries in space. It was wonderful when the Air Force first came into being after World War II. They were the first ones to be leading the vision in every direction. And now they're a bureaucratic obstacle. And it's a shame.
Franz, could you give a couple of specifics for the listeners as to why the Air Force, or how the Air Force has been failing in its mission?
Well, I mean, other than the generalities, my article a few years ago gave some specific examples, I believe. Certainly the cost of systems that grows over time. And I won't mention specific systems, because I probably shouldn't, just out of respect for, you know, security, whatever you want to call it. But I can just say that they're probably easily researched, and the information is publicly available. Everything is late. Everything is over budget. If a company were to behave like that, it would fail.
But NASA acts the same way. As do, look at how hard it was for you to get an armored land vehicle to protect troops in Iraq and Afghanistan.
This is the nature of the beast, and I mean it's certainly not an epiphany for anyone that there's been a whole history of this, not just maybe in the DOD, but in other aspects of the U.S. government. But what it does do on the positive side, and we have to look at the positive here, because having all these problems without solutions, even independent of a space force or space service, the fact that the commercial industry can take on these wonderful ideas. But they need an insurance backup. They can't take risks, or they're going to fail too. I mean, if something terrible happens, it could mean the end of one of the new space industries right away, unless they have a government insurance policy that allows them to fail, that allows them to go forward with their broad imagination, their brilliant ideas, whatever they may be, and we could discuss two dozen of them right now. But as long as they have the insurance policy, you know, I'm thinking off the top of my head, Jeff Greeson came and spoke to us from Excor the other day. And, you know, it would be wonderful to know that for Scale Composites or for some of these other wonderful companies, that there was this automatic insurance backup that the government would guarantee that, okay, you may fail. It's okay for you to fail in some area. We got your back. We'll cover the losses. And we'll allow you to do a second iteration or a third iteration. So, yeah, that's a good side, I think.
John?
Do you think that's feasible?
I think it takes a forcing function, and it takes a forcing function certainly above the level of DOD. It would be wonderful to see someone at the level of SecDef, our new Secretary of Defense, or above the level of Secretary of Defense, to acknowledge this problem with space and the Air Force and the inability of rapid innovative innovation, for lack of a different word, in operationalizing space. I don't know if that will happen. That would be one forcing function. The other forcing functions, I don't even want to begin to contemplate because they could be even worse. But you know, we're in tough times fiscally across the board. So I think the forcing function, the best forcing function, would be from within the U.S. government at the level of the new Secretary of Defense or above him to say, let's try something new. Let's create a new service. And that's on that part. And then that would enable the rest of the story. When you got a new service, it will have a budget. It'll have a piece of budget that takes from all the other budgets. Well, you know, tough luck for the other services. They have to carve up that big pie of services. They will get a slice of it, an appropriate slice, so they can continue with the space mission and build towards the future. At the same time, that same organization would be able to provide the insurance policy for the commercial industry to succeed with the most adventurous, the most optimistic, and perhaps the higher risk innovations.
So what does that do for the people that are already alarmed at the, for lack of a better word or term, and so I'm using this as a broad term, you know, catch-all phrase, the weaponization of space? If all of a sudden we have created a space military force akin to the Army or Marines or the Navy or the Air Force, but their domain is space, have we now militarized, have we weaponized space, have we really escalated the possibility of warfare in space?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because that comes down to what you specifically do in space. We don't orbit weapons in space. We don't do that. There's UN treaties on that, and we abide by them. Would that open the door to new ideas that would? I don't think so. There would be no difference in terms of following international law and agreements with other countries. That wouldn't change at all. But those space assets that we do have, for the purpose of, let's say, information, okay, we'll leave it at some general level like that. The information piece that is specific to the national security and is considered national, I mean, that piece that's being handled supposedly by the Air Force so well, it will be handled much, much better. And that's the first step. In other words, it would be a more efficient handling, and it would also protect the resources for that regime, because I think I mentioned it in my old article, that there has been a habit over the years that the Air Force has borrowed against space programs to pay for the continuation and the survival of their terrestrial aerospace programs.
Let me ask you both a question. I'm going to step in. The history is we started out with Army Air Corps, and then later on, we switched to a full Air Force service. That was also pretty painful and caused a lot of debate and discussion. Can we absolutely say point blank that carving out and giving the Air Force its own service rather than keeping it as part of the Army Air Corps made a significant difference for developing the world's best Air Force? Could we have done that if we'd kept it as part of Army Air Corps?
I don't think so.
You want to speak first, John? You do it.
John, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think so, because remember a lot of the early development, specifically the experiences of General Mitchell, involved a lot of hidebound traditional reasoning on the part of the Army, and that didn't let the young bucks loose with a lot of creativity prior to World War II. And then obviously during World War II, there was a lot of innovation. And then with the Cold War following, the Air Force became an incredible organization. You'll also recall as the Air Force that developed strategic missiles, and there was some fighting back and forth as to where that line was going to be drawn between the Army and the Air Force and what strategic components the Navy would have. But the Air Force had major responsibility for that with the Atlas and Titan programs and so on. So I think that it really was a positive, even though it caused a lot of heartburn among the other services, primarily because of budget threats. And I think that would happen again. Ron?
Yeah, I absolutely agree it would happen again, and it would be a beautiful thing, because the Air Force is better than any Air Force in this world, bar none. And it could only happen when they did not compete with another service budget, which would have been the Army. Can you imagine if they were going through the same things right now that that they might have in building a Air Force that we have today while still coming under the Army budget? It would be impossible. And so all of this innovation and all of this imagination and all of this capability evolved after they were freed and defined as a service, and their budget was protected, and they had a seat at the joint, at the predecessor on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's how it happens. It has a Title 10 mission, and as should the new space service. Should have a Title 10 mission just like the other services. Yeah, they'll all cry, the Marine Corps will too, about losing some of its budget. So what? The history moves on. You know, her services should not exist for the service's sake. This is not a jobs program. This is taking care of the national security mission. And right now, the space mission is in jeopardy, and it does contribute to national security. So we look at the model that was done before with the U.S. Army Air Forces, and we do it with space as well. And it's really an easy argument to make based on the behavior, recent behavior of Air Force and space, and based on the precedent of the past. My opinion.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of Air Force people and talked to a lot of them, and the competition and fighting, say among the fighter plane groups versus the bomber groups or versus other groups, including space, the internal competition can really be destructive for innovation and leadership and turning the wild bucks with their creativity loose. So I think you run into that square on with space and fighter pilots, bombers, and other missions of the Air Force, which are really not that synergistic with going into outer space.
Ron, in the scenario of a separate space force, where would you put our strategic missile forces? Would you put them in with the space force or leave them where they are?
This is a question that's always been during the Space Commission, when Donald Rumsfeld chaired the Space Commission. That was a very carefully thought through issue. And again, I do not have the expertise because I understand how these things go. They go through space. Things that transit through space are not necessarily space. There's a strange overlap, and of course the strategic mission is so important. And so that was carefully handled in the Space Commission's report. I wouldn't even venture beyond the discussion that they had. And I think the decision was made that this would remain a at least for the time being would remain an Air Force mission. But that's something I'm not qualified to talk about, really.
You know, one other thing, listeners who have an interest in these topics might look for the biography of an Air Force officer now deceased called John Boyd, who ended up
yes.
being more of a hero to the Marines than to the Air Force hierarchy throughout his career, especially the last half.
Absolutely, sir. I would recommend John Boyd to anyone. And yes, he is a hero in the Marine Corps. Unfortunately, his principles, as I have found out, do not apply to the Beltway. Even for the Marine Corps, okay? Outside the Marine Corps, maneuver warfare is fantastic. He's helped transform us along with people like General Gray when he adopted maneuver warfare during his commandancy. But unfortunately, Boyd's thinking never really changed the thinking of the standard bureaucracy, which we discussed before. It should. And well, he certainly made a difference in his time.
He also had huge problems with procurement in the fights that led to development of the F-16 and then also the A-10.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful story, and the fact that it was so real, that it had such an impact on the U.S. military, more than one service, is such a testament to John Boyd.
What is the name of his bio? Do you remember that, John?
I think it was called 42nd Boyd or something like that, because he had three nicknames throughout his life. The first was 42nd Boyd from his fighter pilot days when he had a standing bet that he could start out with a fighter on his tail and end up on the other guy's tail within 40 seconds. And after that, he was called the Mad Major and Pope John. And he played a major role in educating some of the high-level people that were as part of DOD during the first Gulf War and just prior to the first Gulf War.
Yeah, Dr. Juris, and I think, and I feel so stupid that I can't remember the name. He also has a recent biography of him, I believe. And here I am, I'm sitting here talking about him, and I can't remember the name of the book. But I'll I'll send it to David as soon as I recall.
Well, I have it. I don't have it in front of me, but I'll put it in the archives and I'll look it up and get the exact title for it. So what is the likely scenario of going to a separate space force? And do you think, had there been a separate space force, Fran, that the roadmap would have been released?
Yeah, it certainly would have been released. And then we probably would have been told, you're going too slow. Make it happen faster now. That's what it would have been. It would have been completely different. Of course, there would have been. We wouldn't have been doing a roadmap because it already would have been done before us. As soon as a space force or a space service came into being, there would be an immediate roadmap, sort of a vision statement. All the services have these things. They put them out every year, sometimes every couple of years. This thing fits right into that template.
Do we have the need for what we all went to San Antonio to discuss, was to have a space capable vehicle, or maybe it could have been a hypersonic, to get a squad fully combat ready any place in the world as needed for within 2 hours?
Absolutely.
And that has not diminished from today.
That has diminished from today. And, the need is on the books. Never been answered. I don't think the Marine Corps is going to put any money behind it because they don't feel a responsibility to do such that sort of science and technology. And I would agree with them there. That would be something that the executive agent for space or a space service should do, because obviously the Marine Corps wouldn't be the only beneficiary. It would be SOCOM, who also has expressed needs similar to that. And probably an army as well. I mean, it would be a joint capability. And as soon as it's a joint capability, it applies to whichever executive agent is assigned to develop it. And that would or should be the Air Force, and they've done nothing with it.
John, anything else?
No, I'm going to sign off and clear the line, but it was nice talking with you, Franz. And good luck with your future.
John, one final question to you. If you were a betting guy, do you think, you're getting up there in your late 60s, do you think you will be around to see the U.S. go to a separate space force as part of our military? Do you think that will happen in your time?
Not with the current leadership in the United States.
Well, didn't happen with Bush and others either. And
I understand, but I think the odds are certainly not enhanced with the current leadership. As far as the need, I don't know. It seems like the United States collectively is losing its aggressiveness in a lot of different ways. And I find that sad because it directly impacts the state of our economy, our civilization, and our security.
And I share your concerns, John. It was great talking to you. I believe also that we are going into a broad decline, unfortunately, across the board. And this is just a microcosm of a greater decline.
You guys should just go get a job in the public sector. You'll be riding sky high. Trust me.
Hey, nice talking to you, John.
John, okay, thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Bye now.
That does free up the toll-free line for those of you who would like to call and get in on this discussion. 1-866-687-7223. Franz, can you tell us what's in the roadmap? Can you highlight some of the key areas? Because, again, the listeners, they really don't know what we're talking about because they've just heard us talk about it with you and Paul and John and Dave Hook. You know, maybe two or three times on shows since we went to that Lackland Air Force Base conference, but nobody's ever seen it except us.
No, I think a lot of people have. I think it was, I want to say, and somebody can correct me, December of 2009, I think I sent out a pretty advanced draft based on, because I got some great input on the first draft, because we really weren't going in the right direction, as you would call, on the first draft. And we radically rewrote it collectively, and everyone did a tremendous job on the industry side of participating to that rewrite. And then we put out several advanced drafts later on. I want to say it was late 2009. And in principle, it really hasn't changed much from them, content-wise. There's been wording changes. I think that with the NSSO, we worked in a little bit more, not only of the history of SUSTAIN, but also that the things that preceded SUSTAIN. Suddenly General Medeiros arrived, and his vision and his contributions. And then before that, the Army Air Corps and the transition to Air Force and the great Air Force leaders who early on in the RAND Corporation study and stuff like that. So those things have been fleshed out a little bit. That's just history. The minutes from the space conference haven't changed a bit. I mean, it was sustained focused and it remains sustained focused. However, we opened it up, of course, and everybody had lots of ideas that they contributed in a non-proprietary way, which we're very thankful for, put it out there to show whoever, when the roadmap is published or was to be published, that they could show, hey, look at all the chances for cooperation. Look at where we can work together and going to their advocates and decision makers and going to members of Congress, et cetera, and to the Air Force to try and stimulate some way forward. And so we, of course, presented the needs. Everything that was in there in those late drafts, and I believe everybody saw them. I think I tracked pretty well. I sent it out in four portions at one point, I think, because some people's emails weren't capable of taking a 10-megabyte document. So I think everyone is going to be happy with it because it really hasn't changed much from the last thing they saw. If anything, it got stronger in a couple areas. One thing I'll say, you know, there were discussions about funding, you know, with over the years and stuff, what can be done in the various, I guess, major technology points, the maturity of various technologies and all. And, you know, that has to be considered rough estimates. You'd probably have to have roadmaps to grow out of this roadmap on any given area that we discussed. But it was a start point. But in terms of the content, what we did at the conference, what was the purpose of the conference, the RFI responses, and the individual contributions from the individual industry participants, and that list of needs and paragraph discussions on each, that hasn't changed at all. It's only gotten stronger and better and maybe checked for typos at most and maybe a few more extra pictures of different sorts. Now, in rewriting it, like I said, again, representing the university, don't want to represent the university, just myself, but hopefully they will find the rewrite of use to the Singularity University without taking a single change to the content and, in fact, actually enhancing it. And one of the things we're going to come down particularly hard on in the roadmap, maybe a little more so, because certainly I have allies on that here is on the ITAR restrictions and how that restricts the commercial space industry from doing so many good things and others from doing good things outside of the United States. So that critique might get a little stronger. But otherwise, the roadmap from the last stuff that everyone's acquainted with has not, from the last draft that I sent out in four pieces some time ago, I think everyone will be pleased. And they're welcome to go to that website that you're going to post on your website, that they can take a look at it. And if there's any inputs that they want to give, that'd be great. And because of this long delay, I also want to add that, you know, I have no doubt that some projects have progressed even further. And as sad to say as that is, 2 years waiting for a document to come out, a lot of progress has been made in various areas. And if people want to take a look at what they provided prior for the roadmap that they see in the draft and want to update it a little, hey, go for it. I'll do it immediately. Whatever suggestions I get on updating the individual companies and what they are doing or thinking about doing, I'd be glad to take those inputs and rewrites and make it even better. Because I want to make sure that there's absolute fidelity. If I mention someone as a participant in the roadmap, especially if I've got their non-proprietary stuff in there, I want to make sure that the fidelity is 100%, especially at current. So I absolutely welcome any changes, because right now I'm in the crafting phase. And now it's going to go pretty quick. I can guarantee you that.
Listener, it is a 199-page PDF when you go to the link that I'm going to provide you in the archive write-up. We have a caller on hold, but for those of you that are listening with a pencil, and here it is, although it is pretty long, so it's www, and this is all one word, spacedebrisresearch.com. So spacedebrisresearch is /space_debris_research, then /roadmap.html. And you have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you, please?
Hi, David. This is Dave Hook.
Ah, the Air Force is going to retaliate for Franz's, Franz's statements, right?
Remember, they were only my personal comments. Please. I represent nobody but myself.
No. First of all, Franz, I want to congratulate you, certainly for your courageous move to put this on the Internet, so that folks can go to it and see what it was that we were all moving towards, and so I want to pat you on the back for that.
Thank you, sir.
And an observation and a question, Franz. What do you think of this in terms of sustain? It seems to me that, you know, what really tends to drive military acquisition is both threat and a need. And if, for example, we didn't have all the forces forward in Afghanistan and in Iraq, it would seem to me that lacking forces forward, we'd probably need to have a sustained type response, let's say, if Pakistan's nukes got loose. We really would need some sort of extremely rapid and capable force, and that would tend to drive the need for sustain, and I think it would also tend to make the case for the new service. What do you think of that?
I absolutely agree, sir, and that goes back to when General Bedard signed that thing in the first place. He said exactly those sorts of scenarios, and there really are. If you're talking one, two, or three squads and three various space platforms, clearly you're talking about narrow applications, but they're going to be strategic applications, and the, you know, the loose weapon of mass destruction scenario is a classic one that would particularly fit SOCOM. It would certainly fit the Marines and others. And that would, you know, tell you the truth, in a global world, it would fit any nation who is concerned about those things. That's obviously one of the things that was in the back of all of our heads when we wrote that thing. You know, you're going to have. I mean, if you're talking about massive forces, obviously sustain is a niche capability. It's a niche capability for a limited set of missions that where the cost, there's always going to be a cost associated with deploying anything, is involved. But absolutely, in this day and age, in the super empowered age. You remember what Admiral Zabrowski said about super empowerment, and it's all coming true. You know, you think of Timothy McVeigh, you think of 9/11. Individuals, regular guys, knuckleheads, going ahead and with limited means, or maybe some special means, they have strategic impact all by themselves. And so sustain, especially if it's a remote opportunity, will be wonderful. And I think I could see a whole shared world concern for something like that. And of course, I'm having a more comprehensive view of these things a little bit in the environment that I'm in right here at Singularity University, because you have a bunch of compassionate, conscientious folks from all over the world here.
Saying this to you guys, if we had a sustained vehicle that could take a squad, 2 hours any place on the world, you guys could have delivered a squad combat ready to that island in Norway probably before the cops got there.
Literally,
to put that in perspective, and I know that's an extreme police response for anybody in any country, but to think that you could have given an order, launched that thing, combat-ready Marines, egressed onto that island, and killed the son of a bitch before he did as much damage as he did before the Norway cops got there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Another one that's been mentioned before, we've talked about it, is, and in fact, it was the inspiration for sustain. It was Lieutenant Colonel Rosy LaFontaine when he said, it was right after or right before Tora Bora there in Afghanistan, and he said, if we could have gotten someone there that would have kind of cut the OODA loop, as John Boy would have said, on the delay that caused the ability of Osama bin Laden to get away early, it would have been wonderful. It probably would have, who knows how the world might be different now if that had happened. And so that's what inspired it. And you know, the example from Norway, I don't know enough specifics, and I don't even know what the space platform would look like. But even, and this is the thing that General Bedard got to early on was, you know what, okay, squad of folks, that's great. That's our traditional Marine way of thinking. And it's obviously the hardest problem, too. But even a capability, and if, you know, with the advancements of robotic systems and AI in its infancy now, just to get the capability, one that didn't require man rating, you know, to have a vehicle to be able to insert that capability onto the ground and do something extremely decisive and meaningful in like no time, it would be wonderful. And you know, we've already seen how robots can be operated from other continents. We've seen that in various respects over the last few years. The same thing can be said for sustain being able to insert something now and take care of it. Because General Bedard in no way wanted to confine the, and General Zillmer after him, no way wanted to confine the idea to just manned transport. He wanted to look at the transport capabilities, which would include robotic capabilities. So anyways, the need is there, across the board, manned, unmanned, the ability to get there fast, to mitigate, intervene in the conflict before it's escalated. And your Norway example is a good one there.
Dave, would you have changed services from the Air Force to the Space Service?
Well, now, I'll tell you, there is a strong chance that I would have. When I went to the Air Force Academy, it was with the idea of getting into the space program, and I ended up dating computers for 4 years, as opposed to having any kind of reasonable social life, if one could have that as a cadet. And I got a degree in astronautical engineering, so I think it wouldn't have taken too much of a push to get me to do that.
For both of you, I have a comment from Bill in Virginia, and Dave, since you were part of the our sustain group and we're at the workshop, you can also respond to this. Bill in Virginia says, Franz, how is your perception of the attitudes of participants at the Air Force meeting at Lackland Air Force Base to the roadmap being held up and suppressed by the Air Force. Do you have any feedback on that?
Well, yeah. I've seen a letter, a very polite but very direct letter from participants to the a particular undersecretary in the Air Force, expressing concern that how can something like this that was so apparently important to the Air Force at one time is suddenly not important at all. I've seen that. That's what I can verify. I can tell you that as a participant, I can only speak for myself personally. I'm extremely angry. And there was another word in there that I didn't use because we're on this program. I'm extremely angry about this. I think it's at an institutional level, it's disingenuous. And I think the participants in the development of the roadmap are rightly angry as well. But all I can do is, in terms of being a witness to the disdain, I've had many private conversations with folks and some private emails who are participants have not been happy. But that letter says it all. The letter that I saw says it all. And I just leave it at that.
David, I know you signed the letter, as did John and I, and it was very frustrating knowing that we traveled to San Antonio all on our own nickel. We gave up 3 or 4 days. I mean, we had a great time, especially with you showing us around San Antonio. I mean, it could not have been a better period of time and bonded all of us together from the lobby of the Hilton to your van to everything. But it was very frustrating that what we came there to do could not get released. Any comments from you?
Well, just simply, from the business point of view, it was a poor investment choice. There was effort put into it and little or nothing to show for it. Now, Franz, that's not to say that the great work that you put forward, isn't worthwhile. But in terms of the sponsoring institution actually moving forward after having received essentially what were gifts from industry, nuggets from industry, and doing nothing with it, that was frustrating.
And you know, people, just to stress the point at the caliber of who was at this meeting, because maybe some of you don't know, Boeing Phantom Works was there. Dr. John Clark, probably one of the foremost NASA medical doctors and people involved in crew and egress safety from a space vehicle. I mean, world renowned. Tabor McCallum of Paragon in Tucson. Dr. Juris, Dave Hook. I mean, the teams were unbelievable. There were 70 or 80 of us there from industry that came there to explore ways to do all the different components. And we broke up into group, like life support. How do you get your crew there capable of getting off the damn vehicle and being able to pull the trigger? Others were, how do you transport them and monitor their condition during the flight? How do you get wounded, Marines back? How do you pick them up and get them back out of the mission? All of this was divided into different working groups with the best of the brightest. And then to see it not get released, the collective mental power and leadership in that room from industry was unbelievable. I mean, truly, truly, truly unbelievable. So for Bill in Virginia, that's the feedback about what the delay did. You, as David Hook says, you had a gift from industry that brass, I guess that's the term, sat on for whatever their reasons were.
Well, and here again, I'll add to that. And when we talk about the Air Force, you got the Air Force and you got the Air Force, just like any other service. You have what I call the inspiring Air Force that we envision when we think the word Air Force, and then you have the corporate Air Force. And the corporate Air Force is at the Pentagon, and is the issue at hand here, in terms of the wonderful Air Force that went away at the hand of corporate Air Force, the NSSO. You had Mr. Rouge. He was wonderful. He's a hero of mine, that he was able to lead this. And, you know, it's just like the solar power study that got all sorts of expressions of concern, you know. He was leaning forward. He's doing the right thing. And Paul Danfus, geez, you know, he did everything he could in his own very diplomatic way, which he has to be in that environment to get this thing done. So they did their part. They did more than their part. So again, it's a corporate issue, and it's disgusting. I mean, it is. I mean, the Air Force should be embarrassed at the corporate level. You know, they should issue an apology, but they won't, of course. But this is an embarrassment, and it shows again what a bad customer the government is, or the DOD can be, for the industry who's willing to take some risks.
David, I tell you what, I'll just leave you with a thought, and then I'll clear the toll-free line for
okay. Go ahead.
And that is, you know, when the Air Force was created, it didn't come easily. It actually cost a brilliant man at the time, Billy Mitchell, his job. And Brigadier General Mitchell, you know, basically had to go toe-to-toe with folks who were much larger and more powerful and whatnot, but he was able to make the case for a separate service. And so to the end that Franz was discussing earlier of having a separate service, the challenge is going to be breaking away roles and missions from commands, Air Force commands, that already enjoy those manpower billets and those budget sources for their mission.
Oh, and can I add to that, David? Can I respond to that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, Dave, the way I had envisioned it always, and I think not just me, I mean other people have too, is that it doesn't go away for those guys. They just change uniform. You have this wonderful, wonderful cadre of space professionals in the Air Force, the best, and the civilians, uniform and civilians, and all their functions spread out all over the place doing fantastic things. They then become a different service, a new service. Nothing changes in that respect. But I'll guarantee you their budget gets protected, and they have a boss who sits on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he sits next to the Air Force and all the other services as a co-equal vote. No one will ever rob from space to pay for a terrestrial aerospace program unless it's done at the SecDef level out of national necessity.
Well,
that's where the protection comes in.
I could see that happen, perhaps, but I think that there are two sides. You mentioned the what I call the operators Air Force, you know, the folks that actually go out and do the mission, and then the politicians Air Force.
Yes.
And to that end, you need to have a Billy Mitchell who makes the case for the operator's side and talks about, you know, how the mission fits and doesn't fit in certain places. And then you need to have, sort of like NASA had as its initial top cover, you know, Lyndon B. Johnson, when he was basically flying top cover for NASA as a brand new organization. You need to have someone who knows all the political skeletons in the closet, so he can get the support and he can do the political Aikido, you know, with the opponents and be able to make it happen. But I think you really do need to have two particular types of characters to actually lead and make this happen.
Agreed 100%, and that's something that can't be guaranteed. I'm certainly underqualified to be a Billy Mitchell, but I'm also underqualified from a different reason too, is because, you know, I'm not an Air Force officer, and that's where it would really need to begin. I agree with that. But, you know, whatever us outsiders can do to prompt that argument from within. We tried. General Bedard tried that in many ways, and so did General Zilmer. Well, I won't say they made that case outright. But they were suggesting it in as general officers do. They suggested in very clever ways that, you know, it ought to be in the trade space of consideration. But the real initiative, like you said, the Billy Mitchell, has to come from within the Air Force. And he has to say, you know, enough is enough. And then on the political side, you're right. Then it has to be somebody at a higher level in government. And I say SecDef and or higher. It would be wonderful if it was a SecDef himself. And says, okay, I've heard the arguments. I've seen what's going on. And, a new space service makes sense. It's not going to increase the top-end budget necessarily. All we're doing is carving out a piece. We're putting somebody in charge, be a four-star who sits on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Nobody moves. Everybody continues to do their mission. But now they're protected, and now we're willing to work with industry and let industry take the risky lead, and we're the insurance policy on new stuff. My thoughts only.
Well, Franz, I wish you the best of success, and David, thank you for letting me be on the space show.
Always, David. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
Cheers.
Franz, we're going to take a break. We're an hour into the program. Listeners, stay where you are. Our line is open if you want to call in, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Monday Space Show, and we're talking to Franz about the technology roadmap stemming from the sustained workshop that several of us went to in San Antonio several years ago. It is up on a website that you will be able to access. Again, I'll put the URL in the archive write-up so you can download the 200-page or so PowerPoint or PDF if you choose to do so. Franz, you mentioned to me before the show that one of your projects at the Singularity University in the Space Division has to do with orbital debris mitigation. Can you talk a little bit about what your project is about?
Yeah, sure, gladly. And at this point, today is a decisive day. We've been choosing teams here at the school, which particular team we're going to stay on with for the remaining 5 weeks of the school. And, of course, I've been on the space team from the beginning. And it looks like 99% certainty that we are going to be taking a look at the space debris, space debris issue. Now, we're going to be looking at space debris under the context of the interests of several students. Every student has a different interest coming from around the world here at Singularity University. And the overarching umbrella vision is international. It has a more of an international perspective led by one of our colleagues, Yasemin, where she looks at the the ability of participation in through education links and still being defined a process of getting everybody interested in and participating meaningfully in space-related topics. And exploration or whatever you want to talk about around the world. And this is like talking maybe a post-ITAR regime. So it's ambitious at best. We're going to have somebody be looking at the ITAR issue as well. Crowdsourcing, using crowdsourcing to mine information from various sources to make new discoveries, et cetera, et cetera. Peter Diamantis spoke to us, our group, the other day, and he said it was remarkable how much data there is at NASA alone that needs to be looked at, that's never been looked at, and mined for data. And there's so much that can be done through crowdsourcing. Again, if it ever touches on ITAR, of course we're going to try and address that issue too. Now, under that umbrella of the sort of a participatory, overarching umbrella that could be, nationally, but hopefully international, we're going to use a case study, and we're going to use space debris mitigation. And that's my passion, and it's also the passion of Lucy Rogers, who I consider my boss on this, Dr. Lucy Rogers. She's a student from Great Britain. And I'm working in support of her to see if we can get a handle on the space, really describing the space debris problem as it is now and projected into the near and midterm. And so we're learning fast. Obviously, I'm no expert on it, so I'm reading like a madman, but I'm seeing that it is critical to resolve that growing problem if commercial space is going to succeed, or the New Frontiers and all these guys are going to succeed in the near term. You got to get rid of that crap, or we can't do anything up in LEO, maybe even beyond LEO, and going through LEO. Everything becomes higher risk. And so this is what our hope is that we have that this umbrella, which will be done by other students that noted, and then Lucy and I will focus specifically on the case of space debris. Well, in the process of looking at it, we're going to be looking at something like also some mitigation mechanisms, which I know have there's many out there, tethers, robotic tugs, ion engine propelled tugs. But also recently, very recently, and NASA put out, an RFI to take a look at high-energy lasers to help solve the problem in a different way. Maybe ground-based lasers to cause surface ablation on some objects and be able to, or outgassing, and maybe propel them into different orbits, either slow them down and cause atmospheric friction to come about sooner, or to push them up and out of the way. So there's all sorts of technologies we're looking at the mitigation means, but we're also looking to define the problem, and that's what I want to do. Is I want to define the need, and so that's kind of my adventure here if we get all the permission to do so. And so space debris is currently my interest and focus, and I would love to learn more. And you mentioned, of course, put me in contact, and I'm sorry I don't have my computer in front of me, but the gentleman who is an expert on this, we would love to have him come out and speak here, I'm sure. I could talk the school into getting him on the schedule. And so we're just taking off here, but space debris is us right now, and that's the reason I think you saw this. When people go to look for the roadmap, they're going to see it falls under the website of that name. We created that website. Lucy and I created that website today, just so we could hang the roadmap on something, so we didn't have bandwidth problems.
What kind of timeline is there for your debris project? And are your conclusions, is your report made public?
Well, here's the thing. This is what we'd like to do. And this is the one thing that would actually be a content addition to the roadmap, is we could expand on that topic as a separate need. And I think we've talked about space debris and salvage in the roadmap, but it received probably a paragraph or something like that. We would like to expand that particular paragraph, and I'm hoping that everyone's okay with that, and describe how it affects all the other plans for the new space industry and the other things that we do, how that we have to take care of that problem concurrently, or at least manage it. And I've been reading about things like this, I guess it's called the Kessler threshold, these things about where debris is sort of a chain reaction, uncontrolled chain reaction, where debris creates more debris. These are nightmare scenarios. And being able to describe these in much greater detail in the roadmap, and then if, and I say if because I do not represent the university, but if the university were to consider publishing the roadmap in their name, that then that could be their contribution to the space roadmap. And I think it would be a harmonious fit with everything else that we were talking about in the roadmap. Especially, you know, it fits right down Dr. Clark's safety piece, certainly, for manned space, but certainly for everybody else. Space tourism, can you imagine how that might affect if the space debris problem becomes worse than it already is? Imagine that, how that affects insurance rates for space tourism. I mean, it could be a showstopper if it got too bad. So I think, you know, I think for many people, space debris mitigation is not necessarily the sexiest topic, which is understandable. But you know what? Somebody's got to do it. And if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? And so Lucy and I, and hopefully a couple other team members, are gonna go after this problem and define it to the best of our ability within 5 weeks.
So,
that's the best I can say.
So your timeline is 5 weeks from now.
Yeah, 5 weeks, probably less. And again, at the same time, concurrently, if people have anything they want to improve on what they see on the website there, of course, I think I have a good record of faithfully improving on the roadmap. So trust me again, I'll do a good job of that. If you want to improve any of the areas that you see on the draft. I worked very carefully, especially with Dr. Clark, on his inputs, which he has an extensive part of the roadmap now, the things that he helped write up on that, and which he wrote up, I should say, that he wrote up on the roadmap. And so, fidelity to the inputs is very important to me.
You have an email question from Carl in Boston. And he says, Franz, now that you are down the road a couple of years and you know the outcome, if you knew that going into this, what would you have done different to try to come up with a different outcome?
Wow, that's a great question. What would I have done differently?
That's what he wants to know, yeah.
I think I probably would have done the same thing. I think all of these efforts are it's the disruptive nature of let's just take the space issue. All these visions of this visionary stuff from the new space industry is very disruptive, right? It doesn't seem that there's a market here. You know, there have been books written about this stuff. And it's always hard. And so this 2-year delay, however unfortunate it is, hasn't diminished my enthusiasm for the project at all, and the need to get it out there. So I think if I had worn out and just said, ah, hell with it, you know, and left earlier and not gotten involved, that would have been too bad because, you know, I gotta show some gumption and see it through to the end, or what's my worth if I can't do that, and so, I don't think I would have done anything else differently. I would have probably been, you know, people would have told me, okay, this is what the outcome's going to be, and I would have said, no, I can still do that, you know, I'll manage. And I probably would have run into the same situation I'm in today. We would have run into the same situation we're in today. So I wouldn't have changed anything, even if it is hopeless in the end. I don't think it's going to be hopeless. I remain optimistic.
Do you think you could have sanitized the content in such a way to not sacrifice the content, but maybe to have made it more palatable and or more Air Force compatible, simpatico?
From what I understand about the negotiations, because remember, what is hanging on that website was met the satisfaction of the NSSO. So in other words, from the Air Force standpoint, at the NSSO and below the NSSO and beyond, it was properly sanitized, balanced. It was politically on the mark. Everything was done right. All we had was, I think, in the end, all you will see is four recommendations. And those four recommendations are pretty consistent over time. Maybe they were five at one time, but it's four recommendations. Now, everybody here can help contribute to them. We never signed the Air Force up to anything. And in other words, money. And we suggested things. We suggested things, and maybe you want to take a further look. I think even Paul had some very good last-minute modifications that weren't incorporated, but would even make it even more palatable by saying, "Let us suggest future studies." You know, what I mean? You've seen that stuff. We would like to submit this. These are good ideas. We'd like to submit them for further analysis. Well, you know, those are nothing statements, and sometimes it makes them more acceptable. But I don't think it would have changed anything. For whatever reason, even though the roadmap didn't sign the Air Force up to anything, there was a decision made that this just wasn't interesting enough. And that's what's tragic about it. And that's a lack of vision. That's the way I see it. So, nothing would have been different. Nothing probably would have been different. You could have reworded it, you could have stood it upside down and turned it left to the right. It doesn't make any difference. Obviously, there is no vision on this, and there is no interest in doing something visionary that might suggest that the commercial industry has a leadership role.
So why did they help sponsor and allow this workshop to unfold at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio?
Because you had a different leadership in place.
So the leader, the Air Force leadership changed, the general in charge of the Air Force changed, or what specific leadership are you talking about?
I won't be any more specific than that. People change, people move on, new people come in. All I know is that the NSSO can no longer champion it because the NSSO is now, doesn't exist.
Now, I remember, talking to Paul Damfus. He's at a couple of conferences that I attend regularly, and Joe Rouge was at one of them, and we were talking to Joe, and he said it was on his desk ready for signature, and Joe, I believe, you know, I can't speak for Joe under any circumstances whatsoever, and I never was able to have him as a guest on the space show, though I wanted him to be on. But I believe he would have signed it, but then NSSO got disbanded and trashed, and the budget got canned. I mean, you know, it went to hell in a handbag shortly after. This was at a Responsive Space conference, I think, at the Westin Hotel in L.A. And I guess the rest, as they say, is history, right?
The rest is history. All I'll say is the positive. When it comes to personnel, I'll just say the positive about people. Mr. Rouge is my hero. He's the one who got this thing moving. As a Air Force, as a general, because he's an SES, that makes him a general. And so the Air Force, under his leadership, as I put it, got this thing moving, supported it, and yes, it was ready for signature, and then things changed. And I can say no more. And all I can say is it's tragic. It's tragic. And I know... You know, again, I don't want to speak. I cannot speak for Mr. Rouge. It would be totally irresponsible.
Absolutely.
It would be totally irresponsible for me to speak for Paul Damfus. All I can say is what happened.
Absolutely. And listeners, by the way, for those of you who are planning to attend the New Space Conference at the end of this week, it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at NASA Ames. Franz is going to be there, and you will be able to meet him and carry on a longer conversation with him about this or whatever you like. You can't miss him. He may even get a chance to say something publicly about the roadmap. I'm not sure if at this late.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to happen. Like to. It'd be fun to, you know, to be a spring butt and be able to get up there and, you know, and announce that you know, we're considering it. But, you know, realistically, maybe that won't happen. But I look forward to meeting anybody that's interested in it and take input. And again, it gives a chance also for my teammates. I think it's particularly important for my teammates in the space team. Because of course Yvonne Cagle's gonna be there. You know, she's the astronaut and she's our boss. And she's going to be there, I'm sure. I'm sure Pete Warden is going to, excuse me, Brigadier General Warden, sir, to me, is going to be there. And so, you know, it's going to be a wonderful time.
Well, Pete is on the schedule to speak.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, I bet.
So, you know, Pete is always there. He's a great supporter.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
And anyways, it would be wonderful if we could get your perspective, whoever's listening, and you are going to be at the conference, to give me and my colleagues, especially my colleagues, and there will be a few of us, a perspective on the utility of a space debris mitigation effort. Independent of whatever the method used happens to be, the importance of space debris mitigation to your industry and how that might have a benefit in terms of cost to your operations especially.
If your team is interested, and at some point when you're able to do that, if you guys would like to do a joint space show program on your team's project and work, you've got the microphone.
Well, I'll tell you what, we want to have, of course, we wouldn't want to waste anyone's time with something that isn't good, but I'll tell you what, by the end of these 5 weeks, we're going to have something, and I will definitely get in contact, and I would love the chance to have Lucy Rogers especially, but maybe Yvonne, maybe Jasmine, maybe Eric, who's also on our team. Any one of them will be a wonderful resource for you and have a fascinating conversation. We will know a lot more about the problem and solution space by that time.
We're down to about 5 minutes from when the show would end. When did Singularity University start? You showed up there when, in June or in May?
I showed up in June. We all showed up in June. I think I want to say it was June 18th, and it ends on on August 28th. I guess that equates to a 10-week program. This is Singularity University's third year of operation, and of course, it was co-founded by Dr. Ray Kurzweil and Peter Diamantis. And the experience it's simply off the chart. I can hardly describe the friendships that we formed. Like I said, I feel underqualified to be here because you need to read the biographies or bios of the other students here. They put me to shame. And I just feel lucky to be here. The staff, you can imagine. I had Dr. Dan Barry was sitting in front of a computer with me, helping me design little robots. I mean, here he is. I mean, this hands-on treatment from the who's who of the scientific and different communities. It's unbelievable. And we have, you know, Dr. Merkla from and nanotechnology. He briefs us regularly. We even had Steve Wozniak from Apple Computers. He was with us the other day, and he spoke to us, and he just hung out with us too. It's unbelievable. It's just like a fantasy land here. But we're going to come out with a very strong network, almost a family, I'd say. Once we leave here, the 80 of us, and we'll, you know, it's with the school, it's an experience I cannot describe. This, no other educational institution in the world is like this, and we're learning the state of the art in the what are called the exponential technologies. Those that are going to one way or the other lead to some significant advances, especially in artificial intelligence in the coming years. Ray Kurzweil's book, A Singularity Is Near, describes it best, of course. And of course, everyone has their own opinion about these things. But one thing about Ray Kurzweil, all he does is lay out the facts. You know, it's like you can like it, you don't have to like it. Here are the facts. And of course, exquisitely researched facts. And if anything, even a tenth of what he says comes about in the time frames he says, it's going to be transformational for humankind, not just for us nationally. And I can tell you right now, the DOD is way behind in their thinking, if they think linearly, and from what we're seeing here.
The DOD is way behind. We think of all of this as America being, you know, on the cutting edge, both in terms of space as well as DOD. Are we at risk here of somehow dropping our cutting edge status?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, no, we've been in. I wrote a paper on this in 2006. I said we're in decline. We're an empire in decline. And you know what? Don't be afraid of it. Don't fight it. I guess you know all great nation states and empires go through this cyclical process. You know, you look at China now. China's on the ascension, right? And the United States in decline. We shouldn't despair. All we should do is like, okay, we got some work to do here. Okay, send the kids to science and engineering rather than to, you know, maybe law school or something else. Not that the other things are bad, but, you know, let's focus on the things that are going to get us to the future. That's going to be very hard culturally, and we see that, of course.
So,
but, yeah, we haven't done ourselves any favors the last few years living off of the surplus produced in the past.
What is the solution in your terms? Is it education or what is it?
I think it starts with education. I any other issues I'd be delving into areas that I'm either not qualified to talk about or they're just emotional feelings about this or that topic. I'll stay away from that. Right here, being in this school, I can say it's education. The education level of our foreign counterparts is just off the chart, and these are so many of them are young kids, and because they know it's important. Somehow they came to recognize, if we want to have a future for either their respective nations or for mankind, it comes down to hard technical education, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, we sort of don't do that as much as we used to.
We're going to lose. I mean, we're going to lose from an, I say that from an egotistical standpoint. We're certainly going to be humbled. Hopefully we don't lose in some sort of kinetic sense, but we're certainly going to be humbled. And maybe that humility will bring us back and get us into a new cycle where we can, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, at least educationally, to compare. But right now we're in bad straits.
A lot of here's where we're short on with the. A lot of guests say and point out how we are, losing our edge in space development in the aerospace workshop. I mean, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today that Andy Pastor wrote. I don't know if you saw it, where Rocketdyne is thinking of getting out of the rocket motor business and selling their entire rocket motor business off, and they've been the primary rocket motor company since the dawn of the space age and before. And why? Because the industry is uncertain. They don't know what the markets are going to be, the future is going to be. It's probably not going to be as profitable. Who knows? It's you can find it on the Wall Street Journal as of today, and I'm not making it up. So when these kinds of things hit us and unfold, I mean, it's easy for a lot of us, myself included, to say, this is the problem, or this is one of the top two or three problems. The real challenge is to find the path forward and the solutions to these problems. That is where all of my guests and myself included come up wanting. It's hard to see a path out of this and a solution forward that isn't decades in the making and paradigm shifting and changing people's cultural values and all sorts of things, because that's what got us into all of this over the last several decades.
Well, unfortunately, it will probably, as always, come down to forcing functions. And those forcing functions will be hideous, ugly, horrible. Who knows what they're going to look like? Why does it have to be this way? But it is. It is what it is. I don't see the change really coming as fast as it should socially. So it'll come down to forcing functions, and I'm really sad about that. The one thing we do have control over, though, and like I said again, is the education piece. We can help encourage our children to go into fields that might build a better future and make us more competitive. But again, it's a free society, and our children have choices too. And somehow it's okay to go easier routes for some of our kids, and that's what the decisions they've made. And this is the issue with free societies. I mean, with it comes this freedom is a two-edged sword, and but it would be nice for us to at least be able to convince our children.
You know, there's a book I read decades ago that is kind of applicable to this situation. I'm probably going to botch it because I haven't thought about this book in probably decades, so it means I'm probably not remembering it correctly. Some of the older listeners may remember it was a really big-selling, fashionable book at the time, probably in the 70s or maybe it was the 80s. And the title was I Never Promised You a Rose Garden.
I've read some Marine Corps recruiting poster that I came in under in 1974.
I never promised you. Well, it was about a mentally ill girl who had retreated and lived in an entire fantasy make-believe world that somehow worked for her on the inside, but none of it was real. And institution and psychiatrist and all sorts of people had tried to help her, and she was stuck in this world. And so here comes this other therapist, and I guarantee you I'm botching the story, but this other therapist spent an enormous amount of time getting to know this girl's world, and then somehow was able to enter and participate in this world with this kid.
Uh-huh.
And once this therapist became part of this fantasy, fictionalized, crazy world, the therapist developed a way to, like, for lack of a better term, take the kid's hand and gently, over time, walk her out of that world into the real world, leaving behind all of this stuff and being fully functional in reality rather than in this dream world. And when I look at what we have done internally over the past several decades, we are really rich on toys and innovations that have made our lives a lot easier, and, you know, gadgetry and features, you know, that make cars incredible, and GPS and all sorts of things that filter into us. And you know, we're sort of toy and gadgetry and special features rich, and yet at the sacrifice of a lot of other things. It's like, to get out of it, education is one thing, but it's as if somehow leadership or visionary people have to really understand where we are as a nation and as a culture, and where different segments of our population are hanging out, and take us gently and walk us back out of it somehow into a different reality. Because, you know, if I talk to half the young people I know, they wouldn't even know what you and I are talking about on the show today.
Yeah.
You know, when you we're losing our edge or this or that, you know, they don't know what we're talking about. If we talked about, you know, having these capabilities and stuff like that, what they know is they've got GPS, or they've got an iPhone, or, you know, whatever the, you know, the sort of outcome output gimmick is that they can latch onto. They can read a book on a Kindle or a Nook or an iPad, rather than having to go buy the hardback book at a bookstore that's rapidly going out of business.
Well, you know, one way of taking them by the hand, perhaps not a little firmly, let's put it this way, is, of course, an introduction of the issue of service. And one thing that may be, in terms of leadership, that, you know, our current President Obama, if he does a second term, or another president, if he doesn't do a second term, could do is reintroduce service. And service doesn't need to be military. You know, we've seen the models before. We've seen them in foreign countries. It doesn't need to be. But the idea of service, that the real world is not the toys and the gadgets, and that, oh, by the way, there's real suffering going on out there, within our own borders and outside of our borders, and that you can help, and that there's a little bit of a sense of altruism and energy. People get energized over the plight of other people. And that they also, in the process, get a little bit of self-discipline. Of course, you know my story. I mean, I love the Marine Corps. I will to my grave, because they transformed me when I was one of those, you know,
I was
a loser kid. And the Marine Corps transformed me. It's changed my whole life. And so the sense of service, maybe that can be reintroduced as a start point.
Listen, I agree, and you're right. It doesn't have to be military service, and it should be for everybody. And, you know, with very, very few exemptions, we should learn about giving back to that which has made us so great and given us so much opportunity. Couldn't agree with you more. Maybe someday we'll have visionary leadership that can actually implement a vision rather than just make a nice PowerPoint out of it.
Yeah.
Franz, I'll see you probably not on Thursday because I'm doing the business plan boot camp, and I think I'm sequestered with the others at the DoubleTree Inn down there in San Jose. But Friday and Saturday I will actually be at the actual conference. My boot camp tour of duty is over with. So I'll look forward to finding you and seeing you there and carrying on more and, you know, in person with you and sharing some good war stories with you.
Can't wait, David. Hey, thanks for letting me speak today.
Always. It's always an honor. And listeners, again, I don't know whether you can agree with Franz and what he said or not said, but and he probably, if we could see him on a webinar, he'd be turning bright red. But you're really listening to an American hero. This guy has saved thousands of our troops' lives at the cost of his career, at the cost of unbelievable personal anguish. It is an honor to be able to bring Franz to all of you. And when you see him at New Space, if you go, I'm not kidding you, thank him profusely for what he has done for our men and women in uniform and for this nation. There is nothing else I can say other than he is a true American hero. I've done space show programs about this, so you can Google him on guest search, you know, or some of the others and find out specifics about what I'm talking about. You're in the presence of a great, great, great hero to all of us. And don't forget that when you meet him at New Space. How do you like that, Franz? That must have turned you red, right?
Well, David, thanks for the kind words. But
it's
to all the listeners, especially anyone listening, if you had been in my shoes and seen the same thing, same information, I know every one of you would have probably done exactly the same thing. So,
and it's all true, listeners. It's all true. Just Google his name, and you'll see the stories and what happened. But, Franz, we cannot thank you enough for being who you are. And as they, you know, I was a Navy guy, so I guess I can't really say Semper Fi, but there you go.
We're both naval tradition.
Thank you very much, Franz. And listeners, Doug Vokage of SETI is on tomorrow night about his new book and also a little bit about what's going on at SETI. Because global financial problems don't just hit governments, as we all know. Thank you all for listening today, and thanks to Franz for being with us. Goodbye from Franz and myself on the Space Show.